KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Congress approves a spending bill to avoid a government shutdown, but many Democrats don't like the deal made. And then Natalie Matisyev and her family are refugees from Ukraine living in Iowa now. Worried about loved ones they left behind and anxious Ukrainians may be told to leave the U.S.
Ukrainians are very kind, hardworking people, and they will bring only good things to U.S.
And later, college basketball's March Madness. What are they so mad about anyway? And stories from a boy who lived in a shell. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, March 15, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Storm Prediction Center is issuing a rare high-level warning for severe thunderstorms in the Deep South today, after the system led to multiple tornado reports in the central U.S. At least three deaths have been confirmed in Missouri, with more injured. And there are more than 200,000 power outages across six states. NPR's Amy Held reports.
Overnight, numerous reports of tornadoes, some destructive, hit parts of Missouri, including the St. Louis area, Indiana, and Arkansas. The system is moving eastward, spurring a highest level 5 severe weather warning for parts of Mississippi and Alabama. Meteorologist Frank Pereira says such a warning is rare.
Those are tornadoes that have the potential to stay on the ground for several miles and produce intense, violent swaths of damage.
Then there's heavy rain bringing flood risk to parts of the Tennessee Valley. At the same time, critical fire weather goes on in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri. Dry gusts that have already contributed to dozens of wildfires forcing evacuations. Amy Held, NPR News.
Stocks rallied yesterday but couldn't erase the big sell-off earlier in the week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The stock market was dragged down again this week by tit-for-tat tariff threats. President Trump imposed 25% import taxes on steel and aluminum Tuesday. Other countries promised to retaliate, prompting Trump to warn of even bigger tariffs on European wine and spirits. The trade war overshadowed some positive inflation news. The Labor Department said consumer prices rose just 2.8% in the last 12 months. Tariffs could interrupt that progress. A survey by the University of Michigan found even Republicans who support the president are rattled by the chaotic rollout of economic policy. For the week, the S&P 500 index fell 2.25%, the NASDAQ dropped 2.4%, and the Dow lost more than 3%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
With the help of Democrats, the Senate passed a stopgap spending bill yesterday to avoid a partial government shutdown. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer had opposed the House-passed measure, but changed his mind, saying it was better to pass it than to allow a shutdown in which President Trump could take more power. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says Western nations are planning to set up a security force for Ukraine to be deployed in the event of any ceasefire with Russia. He said they are committed to Ukrainian security.
I think it's really important at this point that we put maximum pressure on Russia. This yes but is not good enough, and that's why the collective resolve this morning was to put pressure, and we can collectively put pressure on Russia. There were a lot of countries represented this morning, a very strong collective resolve.
Starmer spoke after hosting an online summit with 25 European leaders and allies. There was no representative from the United States. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's kicking out the new ambassador from South Africa, accusing him of hating America and hating Donald Trump. In a post on X yesterday, Rubio announced the ambassador was, quote, persona non grata. Kate Bartlett reports South Africa responded to his expulsion today.
Rubio said the ambassador, Ibrahim Rasool, was a, quote, race-baiting politician who hates America. Rubio's ire came after Rasool said at a seminar that MAGA was partially in response to worries about demographic change and a future when white Americans would no longer be the majority. Vincent Magwenya, spokesman for the South African president, called the ambassador's expulsion regrettable.
We urge all relevant and impacted stakeholders to maintain the established diplomatic decorum in their engagement with the matter.
South Africa has been in Trump's crosshairs since the South African-born advisor Elon Musk falsely accused the government of trying to steal land from white farmers. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Arlington National Cemetery is removing from its website sections highlighting prominent Black, Hispanic, and women veterans. An official told NPR the removals were to comply with a directive to remove all articles that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. Among those removed were biographies of General Colin Powell, the first Black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the 8666 Postal Corps, the first all-Black female unit to be deployed overseas during World War II. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for joining us. The federal government remains open today after Congress passed a stopgap funding bill hours before a midnight deadline. The bill includes a small increase in defense spending and about $13 billion in cuts to non-defense programs, in keeping with Republican promises to cut domestic spending. Republicans got more than the 8 Democratic votes they needed in the Senate to advance the bill, much to the dismay and fury of a number of other congressional Democrats. NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt joins us. Barbara, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This was an abrupt shift from the minority leader, Chuck Schumer. What happened?
That's right. Schumer had said Republicans didn't get input from Democrats when drafting this bill, and so they wouldn't get the Democratic votes they'd need to advance it. Instead, he wanted to pass a one-month funding bill to give them more time to negotiate a deal. But on Thursday, he made a U-turn, and he said he was going to vote to advance the bill. Schumer and the nine other Democrats who ultimately voted alongside him argued the bill was bad, yes, but a government shutdown would be worse. They said it would enable President Trump and his top advisor, Elon Musk, to further gut federal agencies. And their support enabled Republicans to ultimately pass the bill largely along party lines.
Barbara, would it be fair to say that Senator Schumer's colleagues just didn't see this coming?
It would be fair. I was at a conference in Virginia with House Democrats when Schumer made this announcement. I saw jaws drop. I saw heads shake. Members were really upset. They said they felt betrayed because they had voted on this same bill earlier this week, and all but one voted against it. It was a tough vote for a lot of members, particularly those in vulnerable districts. But the caucus banded together to present a united front and make a strong show of opposition. They said that the bill was essentially a blank check for Trump because it doesn't rein in the administration's efforts to cut spending that was previously approved by Congress. Here's New York Congressman Joe Morelli reacting to Schumer's comments.
I think they're going to rue the day they make this decision. I think this just gives, you know, license to the Republicans to continue to dismantle the government. They now have the acquiescence of Senate Democrats.
Members told me they were calling and texting their senators, imploring them not to vote alongside Schumer. So a lot of frustration and anger among House Democrats.
And Barbara, what's the implication of this rift among Democrats at a time when, after all, Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House?
House Democrats felt that they finally had some momentum, you know, as the opposition party. The vote over the shutdown was a rare and big piece of leverage for them. To have unity in the House and then have the Senate Democrats shift course at this late stage is a breakdown in strategy. And New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that it has implications, in her view, far beyond this one vote.
There will be a day where the Senate will need the House to move on something. And if there is an erosion of trust and a breach of trust, such as what is being considered right now, it will make cooperation difficult.
After the vote, she posted that the Democratic votes in the Senate were a, quote, fear-based, inexplicable abdication, and that the Senate owns what happens next. You know, I talked to Democratic strategists about this yesterday, and they said that Senate leadership really misread what constituents want, for Democrats to hold the line, even if it means a shutdown. There's concern that this emboldens the GOP, makes it harder for Democrats to present a unified message. Now, Congress is on recess next week. I expect Democrats will be getting an earful from constituents.
And here's Barbara Sprunt. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has set a goal of a ceasefire deal between Russia and Ukraine. Negotiations continued this week, and U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said at the G7 meeting yesterday,
suffice it to say, I think there is reason to be cautiously optimistic. But by the same token, we continue to recognize this is a difficult and complex situation. It will not be easy. It will not be simple.
But despite peace talks, many Ukrainians in the United States who are here under the Temporary Protected Status Program, or TPS, are reluctant to return home. President Trump has raised the possibility of revoking that program. We spoke to one refugee who fled western Ukraine along with her husband and three young children last year. Natalie Matisev said that unrelenting Russian strikes have made life in Ukraine too dangerous.
The Russians were hitting us all the time, lots of explosions. They were hitting the power plants, and every day we didn't have electricity for 10 hours. And even when kids were going to school and there was alarm, they had to go to bomb shelter and study there. The same thing about me. I was at workplace, and when there was alarm, we had to go to the bomb shelter. And I was scared all the time. When I was in the one bomb shelter and my kids were in the other one, praying for everything will be good. And then we decided just to move from Ukraine because it becomes very difficult.
Was it hard to leave, hard to get out?
Yeah, pretty much, because we left my parents and my husband's parents there, my sister. But we decided that it will be a better place for us to live. My kids couldn't even sleep at night. They were all the time afraid of sounds and of everything what was going on.
You're in DeWitt, Iowa now. How do you like Iowa?
I like it very much. The climate is the same like in Ukraine. And it's so nice. It's so quiet. It's so pleasant here. And you know, our first movie we saw, it was Field of Heaven.
Field of Dreams, the baseball movie in the Iowa farm field. Yes. Kevin Costner, Amy Madigan. It's a great film.
Yeah. Field of Dreams. Yeah, I'm sorry. We love it so much. And there was a phrase, are you in heaven? No, I'm in Iowa.
Yes. Most famous line from the film.
Yeah, we really like it very much.
How's your family doing? How are you putting food on the table, working?
Thanks to the volunteer organization that helped us to come to DeWitt, and they gave us a home, all equipments and groceries. When we first came, we lived without jobs. I mean, we were filing all the documents, passing the driver's exams, and then we were looking for jobs. My husband, he was working actually in Ukraine as cabinet maker, and now he's making cabinets here in U.S. I am working just like a receptionist in a company.
How are your children doing?
They are doing great, and it's just because they have a nice and friendly people around them. They don't know English very well, and it was very difficult for them to go to American school. My kids are going to a Catholic school, and they've got a school mass. And on the first mass, I decided to go. And when my youngest son saw me, he was crying. And the guy from his
class just came to him, hugged him, and said, everything will be okay. And I was crying too, and I realized that the language of love is the same everywhere. It doesn't matter, do you speak English or not? And I was very surprised how kids are friendly and care about my kids.
President Trump is considering revoking the legal status of about 240,000 Ukrainian refugees who are now in the United States.
Yeah, and that's the horrible thing. We just started our life here, and I don't want to lose it, really. Besides, the war hasn't ended in Ukraine yet.
If there were a peace agreement, would you want to go back?
Truly to say no. I feel a bad life here, really. It's a life with new opportunities. In Ukraine, there is no opportunities, because how could we survive there? There is no opportunity to work, so the times are very difficult.
What about President Trump's argument? It's good to have agreement with Russia, and it's good for the fighting to stop, and America has no special obligation to help Ukrainians.
Actually, there was on 1994 signed one, no?
I mean, we should explain the agreement you're referring to is sometimes called the Budapest Memorandum.
Yeah, it was about guarantees of securities if somebody can invade Ukraine. That we gave our weapon back because we were assured that if something will happen to us, U.S. will come and help us.
It was Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine had all given up nuclear weapons from the old Soviet Union.
Yeah. I was only 7 years old. It was shown on TV everywhere that we are so glad that U.S. will help us. We really lived and we were taught on history lessons that U.S. is the most powerful country, our older brother, and we can rely on U.S. So that's why we are so maybe confused about the changing of policy, because for Russians, U.S. is the main enemy. And if they just write an agreement with U.S., they pretend to have a peace. We've got, actually, a couple of agreements, and they invaded Ukraine again. I can't believe them. They show that they are lying all the time.
I don't know if President Trump is listening to us, but have anything you'd like to say to him?
I wanted to say that Ukrainians are very kind, hardworking people. And they will bring only good things to U.S. We buy houses, we pay taxes, we buy cars. Mr. President, please don't revoke the status for those Ukrainians that are already in U.S.
Natalie Matisev is a Ukrainian refugee who now lives in DeWitt, Iowa. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for hearing me.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Residents are assessing the damage after multiple tornadoes were reported overnight in the central U.S. At least three deaths were confirmed in Missouri. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer hosted a virtual call with about 25 leaders today on Ukraine.
He said later they are ready to step up support for Ukraine if there is a peace deal reached with Russia. And the Prime Minister of Hungary said today he'll crack down on organizations that take money from foreign powers. Viktor Orban called such groups a shadow army serving the European Union and what he described as a liberal American empire. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump wants to restart nuclear negotiations with Iran. He sent a letter to Iran's foreign minister this week, delivered through a senior Emirati official from Abu Dhabi. But the president has also levied new sanctions against Iran and said that military options are still possible. Iranian officials immediately rebuffed the gesture and on Friday met with China and Russia to discuss their nuclear program. We're joined now by Ali Vaez, director of the International Crisis Group's Iran Project. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Scott.
The Ayatollah Khamenei noted in his speech this week that the U.S. pulled out of the nuclear agreement during President Trump's first term. Do Iranians feel the Trump administration really wants a deal?
You know, Scott, I have a sense of deja vu looking at developments in the past few weeks, in the sense that just like in his first term, President Trump has expressed keenness for a deal with Iran over its nuclear program, contending that he does not seek regime change and wants to make Iran prosperous again. But his administration has pushed forward a pressure-centric policy, which seems to be aimed at making Iran broke again. And this is why, despite the fact that the Iranians had initially, after November 5th, expressed interest in engagement with President Trump, I think that has now given its place to defiant statements of rejecting talks under duress.
What about the effect of sanctions?
Look, there is no doubt that sanctions, along with mismanagement and corruption, have created a disastrous economic situation in Iran. I mean, they're literally struggling to keep the lights on. The currency has lost a significant amount of its value just in the course of the past few weeks, with the markets losing hope of any possible economic reprieve down the road. But at the end of the day, you know, the Iranian economy is not on the verge of collapse, and the Iranians over the past few decades have learned how to circumvent U.S. sanctions and survive.
How do you see this meeting between Iran and Russian and Chinese officials in Beijing?
So the Iranians believe that Russia and China are on their side, and they need to make sure that they're on the same page in case that there are in the future negotiations, again, with the West, whether it's with the U.S. and the Europeans or just with the Europeans. And they also want to make sure that Russia and China are on their side, given the prospect of the Europeans potentially snapping back the U.N. sanctions, which were suspended after the nuclear deal with Iran was struck in 2015.
And we should explain that France, the UK, and Germany are also signatories.
Exactly. And those powers can still return those sanctions by mid this year, because the resolution is going to expire in October. So there is literally a ticking time bomb in this process, which is what makes it different than President Trump's first term in office.
Iran maintains its nuclear program is for research purposes. Is there a concern that if tensions once again are heightened, they will feel compelled to develop a nuclear weapons program?
Well, this is a dual-use technology, and reality is that Iranians can now produce enough fissile material for a single nuclear weapon in a matter of days, and they have a stockpile sufficient for an arsenal of nuclear warheads, and they're constantly adding to that stockpile. From there, depending on how crude or advanced a device the Iranians might seek, it might be as little as a few months before Iran can claim itself to be the world's 10th nuclear weapon state.
And in the minute we have left, what might President Trump do in his second term to bring Iran back to the table?
I think, you know, again, just like at the first time, they're talking past each other rather than with each other. And the reality is that it really boils down to two simple realizations that if they fail to have, it's not going to work. For Iran, it really boils down to a simple fact that it would not negotiate with a gun to its head. And for President Trump, it really boils down to his desire for personal diplomacy and direct diplomacy. If they get that right, the style right, I think they have a chance on substance.
Ali Vyas of the International Crisis Group, thank you so much for speaking with us today, sir.
My pleasure.
New numbers are out from the CDC, and they report more than 300 cases of measles this year, the highest number since 2019, and it is only March. Most of those cases are related to the outbreak in West Texas and neighboring New Mexico, but 13 other states now report cases too. How much are people both vaccinated and unvaccinated at risk? Dr. Carlos Del Rio is a professor of infectious diseases at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. Dr. Del Rio, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
What's your reaction to these new numbers?
Well, it's not surprising, Scott. You know, after COVID, we saw a drop in the immunization coverage, and we haven't really recovered. And measles is a highly transmissible infection. The term we use in infectious disease is called the R-naught, which is the number of infections caused by one case. And just to take you back to COVID, during COVID, the R-naught was 3 to 5. So, you know, one case of COVID led to 3 other infections or 5 other infections at most. In measles, that number is closer to 18, which means one case of measles leads to 18 cases.
So you trace the source of the infection to people who aren't vaccinated?
Oh, very much so. If you look at the current cases, the current outbreaks that have occurred so far in our country, among those outbreaks, roughly 95% of those individuals are unvaccinated.
Does this trace back to West Texas, or are there several different areas of location, do you think?
Well, there are now 3 outbreaks. One of them is in West Texas. One of them is in New Mexico. And the other ones are cases occurring in different states and different jurisdictions. And they're happening, you know, across the nation. We're seeing cases as far north as Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and New York. We're seeing cases in Vermont. We're seeing cases in California. It really is throughout the nation we're seeing cases.
The cases you mentioned that have now moved north, are they somehow related to the cases in West Texas?
No, Scott, the cases in New Mexico are related to West Texas, but many of the cases that we're seeing in other places are related to travel, and they may be travel that happens from, let's say, somewhere from New Mexico goes to California, but a lot of it is also international travel. The rates of vaccination in many other countries have dropped, and if somebody from measles, let's say, flies into JFK, then that could lead to an outbreak in New York State.
Are there people who are vaccinated who should get revaccinated, I guess a booster?
Well, that's a question that I get asked all the time, Scott, and let me try to make it simple. If you have received 2 doses of the MMR vaccine, which is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, or you have 2 doses of the MMRV vaccine, which is measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella vaccine, you're good to go. The protection of, if you were born before 1957 when measles was widespread and you likely got measles, you're well protected and the immunity lasts for many, many years. We know that the immunity to measles probably lasts, you know, over 100 years, so you don't need to worry about it. Now, if you are not sure, let's say you were born between 1963 and 1967, you may need a second dose of the measles vaccine. If you were born before 1989, it was only recommended you get 1 dose, so, you know, you may want to get a second dose, particularly if you're a healthcare worker or a college student or you're going to be in international travel. And if you were born after 1989, you probably got 2 doses of MMR, so you don't need to worry about it.
What kind of people are most vulnerable, do you think? Is there an age, a location, anything like that?
Well, again, I want to emphasize the most vulnerable individuals are those that have not been vaccinated. And if you look at the cases that have occurred so far in our country during this outbreak, roughly 80% of the cases are under the age of 19, and almost 40% of the cases are under the age of 5, and 95% of them are unvaccinated. So if you're a parent and you want to protect your children, what you need to do is vaccinate them. The measles vaccine is highly effective. It produces great protection. And the best thing you can do as a parent to protect your children is to vaccinate them.
Are you concerned about cuts at the National Institute of Health?
I'm concerned about cuts in anything related to healthcare, you know, whether it's the CDC, the FDA, the National Institutes of Health. They all have different missions. The NIH major mission is research. And yes, any cuts there will decrease our nation's ability to advance science and to produce new science. And every day, you know, we forget that science has benefited so many of us. I was talking to a patient earlier today who was cured from hepatitis C. The cure of hepatitis C is because of drugs that were developed through NIH-funded research. So he's very happy. He no longer has to worry about getting cirrhosis or liver cancer in the future. But I also worry about cuts to CDC. Public health is silent. You don't see it. Public health happens not only at CDC, but CDC gives the money to state and local health departments. And state and local health departments depend on that CDC funding. So it's going to impact every community in the U.S. And public health not only does vaccines, public health does cancer screening, public health does nutritional assessment, public health does so many other things that are useful to the community that, yes, I do worry about that.
Dr. Del Rio, I wonder what you say to people you encounter who may say, look, I don't think vaccines are safe.
Well, the first thing I say to them is I study vaccines, I work in infectious disease, and I know the data on how the vaccine studies are done. And all my children, they're now in their 30s, but my two children were fully vaccinated. And my grandchildren, I have 5, and they're getting all their vaccines. If I thought vaccines weren't safe, do you think I would be vaccinating my kids or my grandchildren? So the first thing is that I believe vaccines are safe because otherwise I wouldn't be exposing my family to vaccines. But the second thing I say is I show them how vaccines have made dramatic impact in the life of individuals. Thanks to the polio vaccine, you no longer are seeing polio. The main side effect of vaccines, Scott, is adults. If you vaccinate kids, they become adults. They don't die of preventable diseases.
Dr. Carlos Del Rio, Professor of Infectious Diseases at the Emory University School of Medicine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you.
Over and over, in the world's oceans, baby seabirds often mistake bits of trash for food. New research in the journal Science Advances shows that ingesting plastic can harm them in unseen ways. Here's NPR's Jonathan Lambert.
The main way biologist Alex DeJersey tells how much plastic a baby seabird has eaten is by feeling its stomach.
When birds are really highly plastic impacted, we can actually feel the plastic rubbing beneath our fingers.
But from the outside, such birds seem healthy. Much of what scientists know about how plastics harm birds comes from studying dead ones. But DeJersey of the University of Tasmania in Australia wanted to study some live birds.
We were really wanting to unpack, you know, what is it like for these birds that are living with just a few pieces of plastic within their stomach, and what are the health consequences of that?
To do that, she and her colleagues turned to blood, specifically the blood of 31 sable shearwater chicks caught on Lord Howe Island. They're about the size of a seagull, and just before they were set to depart on a years-long migration, the team got the birds to vomit and drew blood from low and high plastic birds.
Each high plastic bird averaged about a teaspoon to a teaspoon of half of plastic within their stomach. We were hoping for no plastic birds, but they were actually quite challenging to find on the island.
The team looked for patterns of protein levels that are associated with organ dysfunction and health problems in humans and mice. They first found signs of dysfunction in the liver and kidneys.
It's not a surprise. We know that the microplastics are being filtered by these filtering organs.
It also seemed that plastic was breaking down the stomach lining of the birds.
If you've got big chunks of plastic rubbing around in your belly, you're going to see perforation of that stomach lining.
There were even signs of neurodegeneration.
We weren't expecting that at all.
DeJersey doesn't know how plastics cause these changes, though one idea is that microplastics could be essentially shredding the cells and penetrating organs. It's also unclear when or even whether these protein changes will cause more visible harm. To find out, she'll have to wait and see if the chicks return to the island after several years at sea. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
And later today on All Things Considered, NPR's correspondent in Berlin, Rob Schmitz, covered the German election a few weeks ago and noticed something in the voter data. Nearly half the young people cast their ballots for just two parties, one on the far right, another on the far left. He took a look at what's behind this pull to the political extremes. You can hear what he's found this afternoon by listening on your phone, on your smart speaker, or on your radio. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Syria's new government is looking to the future, announcing the outlines of a new constitution just 3 months after the fall of the Assad regime. The new president already faces challenges. NPR's Jane Araf joins us. Jane, thanks for being with us, and tell us what we're hearing behind you.
Yeah, that's actually a commemoration being celebrated or commemorated all across the country today. It marks the anniversary of the start of the uprising in 2011 that led to more than a decade of civil war here.
A distressing week, reports of sectarian violence and even massacres. What can you tell us?
It is extremely disturbing. The numbers aren't able to be independently verified, but there are credible reports, Scott, that about 800 civilians and regime forces and others were killed in coastal areas. A lot of these were members of the Alawite religious minority, and that's significant because that's the sect that deposed President Bashar al-Assad belonged to. So a lot of these were revenge killings. Now, the government says the forces that did the killings weren't under its control, and it's promised to arrest those responsible. But here's the danger. It's that when minorities and others feel threatened, they turn to armed gunmen, to militias to protect them. And that's what we're seeing across the country.
What's the new constitution trying to accomplish?
In many ways, it brings back parts of the old constitution. The president still has to be Muslim. The main source of law still has to be Islamic law. But the main thing that's receiving quite a lot of criticism is it places an immense amount of power with the presidency. And this is a country with very distinct regions, distinct groups. It's raised worries of even more sectarian violence and worries by these groups that they won't be protected in this new Syria. And importantly, Shara, who is Shara, President Ahmed Shara, he was a member of Al-Qaeda, a Sunni militant Arab. He's now a politician, but the constitution itself has raised fears that he's not committed to an inclusive Syria, which he denies.
And tell us about protests in the Kurdish region. That's after Kurds there agreed to give up control of the area to become part of the new Syria.
Yeah. Yesterday, there were protests held in Qamishli, a city in the Kurdistan region in Syria and in other places. Those people were chanting, "Down with the president." And they believe that the constitution doesn't guarantee their rights or their freedoms. The Kurds cut a deal with the Syrian government announced last week, and they gave up a lot under U.S. pressure and Turkish threats. They agreed to basically join the new Syria, but now they're formally rejecting this constitution as not giving them enough power.
And Israel has escalated airstrikes in Syria. What's behind that?
Well, Israel said it was aiming at the command headquarters of a militant Palestinian group, but we actually went to the site in an upscale neighborhood here. The neighbor said the apartment that had been hit had been vacant for years, and the only casualty, in fact, was a housekeeper in the apartment next door who is seriously wounded. Now, this is a big deal because the Syrian president has made clear that Israel isn't an enemy. But Israel has made clear it will continue to attack targets in Syria. And that threatens to bring in Turkey, which backs the Syrian government and says it won't stand for Israeli interference. So all in all, Scott, a lot of threats here, internal and external.
NPR's Jane Araf in Damascus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Raphael Cormack says people were first drawn to the occult because they sought hope in the unseen. Sound familiar?
The wellness gurus, they also represent something that we want to be true, that if we eat well and think positive thoughts, everything's going to be okay.
Raphael Cormack on his book, Holy Men of the Electromagnetic Age, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Tens of thousands of demonstrators showed up in the Serbian capital today to protest government corruption. The protest began in November after a canopy collapsed at a train station, killing 15 people. Many blame the tragedy on government corruption and negligence. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's expelling the new ambassador from South Africa. He accuses him of being anti-white and anti-American. And a SpaceX rocket is expected to arrive at the International Space Station tonight. It's part of a mission to bring home two astronauts who've been stranded there for 9 months. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Yarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and I look forward all week to saying it's time for sports. March Madness. Who goes on? Who goes home? For both men and women in college hoops, fans fill out their brackets. These days, also their betting slips. Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Good morning, Scott.
Every time I refer to the seeds, who's seeded, I think about a pumpernickel bagel, but I digress. We're pretty sure the Southeastern Conference is going to send a record number of teams to the men's tourney. What's their secret sauce?
Yeah, they could be sending 14. We'll find out, of course, tomorrow on Selection Sunday. But if they do get those 14 schools in, that would be a record. And, you know, part of the reason for this, you could scratch it up to expansion. Texas joined the conference, and that's bolstered the SEC's basketball bona fides. But a lot of it has to do with leadership, Scott. You know, the SEC got a new commissioner in 2015, Greg Sankey. Yeah. He happened to be a former high school basketball coach, and he's really put a lot of resources into turning around the SEC's basketball fortunes, and he's been successful. So forget football for the SEC, Scott. It's a basketball conference now.
Listen, Dukes, Cooper Flagg, freshman, biggest star in the tourney maybe, but he hurt his ankle this week during the ACC tournament and questionable if he's going to return. Duke was considered by many to be the top seed. Now?
Well, you know, they do play Louisville today in the ACC Conference Championship game, and they should win. But obviously their flow has been majorly disrupted. You know, Cooper Flagg-Scott leads the team in, things like points, rebounds, assists, yeah, blocks, steals. There's obviously other talent on that team, but the focus is going to be on getting him right for the tournament next week.
Let me ask you about the women's bracket. Caitlin Clark, of course, is gone from Iowa. But I gather the bettors that she helped attract to women's basketball have stuck around.
Yeah, you know, not sure if you guys have a brackets pool at the NPR offices, Scott, just for fun.
It's been known, yeah.
But March Madness, as we know, it's the biggest gambling event all year round. And the American Gaming Association actually projects that it's getting bigger. There is going to be a 15% increase, they estimate, on betting on March Madness. And a lot of that is fueled by increased betting on the women's game. And, you know, you said it, Caitlin Clark attracted so many new fans to the game last year and the year before. But women's hoops have remained popular. You got new stars like Juju Watkins and Paige Beckers who are attracting fans and degenerates or casual degenerates alike.
John Feinstein, who wrote dozens of books, including a real classic, A Season on the Brink, about Indiana's Bobby Knight died Thursday. Too young, the age of 69, regular in Morning Edition for many years, columnist for the Washington Post. Quite an impact on sports writing, didn't
it? Yeah, I'll say, you know, it's appropriate today where you and I have talked college hoops for this whole segment that we end on John Feinstein and talking about him a little bit, because college basketball was really woven into who he was as a writer and a journalist. And Coach K, you know, the former coach of Duke, Mike Krzyzewski, said he was brilliant. He was one of the best writers for sports. He was polarizing, but he didn't care. He wasn't lovable, and he'll be remembered this week for sure. Yeah.
Michelle Steele, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Thanks again.
Students with disabilities have a legal right to a public education that meets their needs. It's an issue so important to families that U.S. Education Secretary Linda McMahon vowed at her confirmation hearings to preserve that right and the funding that comes with it, even as she works to close the education department. And as Nebraska Public Media's Jolie Peel reports, even with that funding, making certain their child gets the right schooling takes hard work for many parents.
12-year-old Gigi Dahl claps her hands and chants to support her local high school's varsity basketball team in Ashland, Nebraska. Gigi, short for Genevieve, has Down syndrome. Her parents, Jacob and Katie Dahl, smile as they watch Gigi dance. Her dad says she's one of the most popular girls at school.
If we go somewhere and there are people that don't know Genevieve, I'm always surprised. It doesn't really matter where we go. It's, oh, hey, there's Gigi.
She hasn't always felt this at home in her school community, though. At Gigi's old school in Omaha, her parents say she was often separated from her peers. Her mom says Gigi's school would pull her out of her fourth grade class to work on social skills in a kindergarten classroom.
The more I thought about it and the more I talked with other people, I was like, that's just completely inappropriate for a 10 or 11-year-old to be working on her social skills with five-year-olds.
NPR asked Omaha Public Schools to confirm Gigi's placement in a kindergarten classroom, but a spokesperson said they could not comment on individual students. Gigi's parents say she was often sad about how often she was separated from her friends or told to sit apart from them to work on lessons independently. They spent weeks advocating for their daughter before they finally succeeded in getting Gigi out of the kindergarten class, but by then they were fed up.
That pretty much solidified our decision to move the kids out of the district because we have to support her.
A district spokesperson said the district has a, quote, collaborative process to help determine students' needs. They work with parents to develop learning plans and inform families of their rights and their child's rights every year. But the Dolls say the whole thing left them feeling powerless. And that feeling isn't uncommon. Families of students with disabilities are often on their own when it comes to making sure their child's needs are met.
That's not the way it was supposed to be designed, but parents are left with advocating for what they believe their child needs.
Celine Almazan is the legal director for the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, an organization that works to protect the legal rights of students with disabilities. She points to one part of the process that can be especially intimidating for families, the meetings where families and school staff map out what services a student is entitled to.
Parent education is crucial for parents to understand that they are an equal member of the team, even though the dynamics and the way that it's set up, it doesn't necessarily make you feel like you're a member of the team.
Almazan says parents should not be their child's only advocate in education, but that's often how it ends up.
The problem is we don't have the capacity in this state.
Tim Royers is the president of the Nebraska State Education Association, a teachers union. He says it's not that teachers don't want to advocate for their students, they just don't have enough resources.
Unfortunately, right now, a lot of educators don't really feel like the public understands what it's like to teach in 2025 because it's different than it was even 5 years ago. First of all, there's more and more kids that need special education services.
Federal data shows nationwide, 7.5 million students received special education services in the 2022 to 23 school year. That's an all-time high. Meanwhile, a federal survey published in October shows the shortage of special education teachers continues. In Nebraska, schools reported about 150 unfilled positions this school year. At her new school district in Ashland, Gigi's parents say her attitude about school is night and day compared to before.
She loves it. She's totally independent there. They have all the supports that we could ever ask for.
Gigi won't even let her dad walk her into school. And better yet, Gigi's parents haven't had to advocate nearly as much as they used to. For NPR News, I'm Jolie Peel in Ashland, Nebraska.
The new collection of illustrated story poems is told from the perspective of a boy who lived in a shell. His name is Evo, and he lived in an empty moon snail shell on a beach of sand until a wave carried him away. He now lives in an empty moon snail shell on the sea. He was scared at first, but he grew to love it so, as the stories he wrote will show. Evo's adventures are the work of John Himmelman. The author and illustrator now joins us from the studios of WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. His book, The Boy Who Lived in a Shell, Snippets for Wandering Minds. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I guess children are the intended audience, but I sure liked it. How did Evo come to you?
I wanted to tell some stories in as few words as possible for people with wandering minds, and I needed a way to connect them. And Evo was the way to do that. He's the one who was telling the stories. And throughout the book, you're also learning a little bit about Evo as he's getting older and older out in the sea, in the shell.
Could I ask you to read one, The Rumple Twins?
Oh, sure. That's the first one in the story. The Rumple Twins lived in a tree. They ate there. They read there. They wept there. They slept there. They never, ever left that tree until one day. Nope. They're still up there.
You don't need a lot of words for a surprise ending. The illustrations of a giant tree, a couple of tiny twins seem to be happily situated on a branch high above the ground. The stories come first to you or the scene?
Both. It was mostly the mood, the feel of it. I mean, some of them are wry, as I've been told, and some are a little sad because I think there's nothing wrong with a sad story here and there, and some of them are just silly. A lot of these, because they're so short, they're ideas I've had for longer books that just wouldn't work, and I got to plug in these characters that I might have come up with 20, 30 years ago, and I got to actually bring them to life in this book.
Let's continue with Evo's stories. Would you let me have the pleasure of reading Penguin?
Oh, please do.
Penguin sat on a chunk of ice. He bobbed up and down in the southern sea. Room for me? Asked Walrus. Okay, said Penguin. Walrus climbed on, but he was too big. The ice sunk beneath them. Penguin stood on Walrus. They bobbed up and down in the southern sea. And then the illustration is just one of the happiest you can ever imagine of a walrus, his hands tucked over his stomach as he floats, and the penguin seemingly quite happy on top of him.
I should have you read all my stories for me.
Oh, well, it would be an honor. I love them so. I've read that you worked in the library stacks, and that had an important contribution to literature, we'll put it that way.
Oh, yeah. I was in my last year at School of Visual Arts trying to figure out, all right, what am I going to do with 4 years of art school? And at the time, I was working in the Comac Library in Long Island, New York, and I was working in the children's book section, putting away all these classics like Mercer Mayer's books and Maurice Sendak, of course. And my favorite was Arnold Lobel and his Frog and Toad series. that just inspired me. Here's a way to combine words and pictures, both of which I was interested in. And I took a course in writing and illustrating children's books in my last year in college, and I've been doing it since.
Could I get you to read Dolphin's story?
So Dolphin is a recurring character. Dolphin was the nicest creature in all the sea. He shared everything he had. Once he found a crayon. He balanced it on his nose. He gave the crayon to a boy. That boy wrote a story about Dolphin. He liked his first sentence so much, he made it his last two. He wanted everyone to know one thing about Dolphin. What did the boy want them to know? Dolphin was the nicest creature in all the sea.
I love that story. And on the one hand, you think, well, you know, that's all that needs to be said. But when somebody is the nicest creature in the sea, we should say it a lot, shouldn't we?
We should. And of course, it's a dolphin.
Yeah. Subtitle of your book, Snippets for Wandering Minds. Why wandering?
I think there's attention span challenges these days with longer pieces. And I was speaking to that. You could pick it up and put it down at any time. If your mind's wandering, there's no pressure. And especially for kids that feel somewhat challenged by reading longer things, this gives it to them in smaller bites or snippets.
In all of your work, have you uncovered or developed something that's just really essential to reaching into a child's mind and heart?
What I do is I write to make myself laugh. I write to make myself sad. And I just hope that translates to other people, other children. And I think what I have is I have strong memories of how things affected me when I was a child, different emotions. I remember happiness. I remember sadness. I remember excitement. And I don't think those change over the years. If I could touch that in my own stories and my own work, that hopefully that will relate to others. And I don't mind adults enjoying it as well. That's how I start. You know, I'm an adult, so I start writing from me.
Can I ask you to read or sing even from Everything Stinks?
Oh boy, I'm not going to sing it. That's Krabby's story. So what happened was when Ebo sleeps, the stories don't come out. And it's the stories that keep his shell afloat. So Crab decided to come in and write some stories. And being a crab, his stories are somewhat crabby. So one of the stories he wrote is Everything Stinks. Sing along time, sang the crab who sang. Nothing goes right. Everything's wrong. Nothing is nice. Blah, blah, blah. Everything stinks. Nothing's worth doing. You're all too smelly. Blah, blah, blah. And you're all too loud. Everything's boring. Sun's in my eyes. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 blah. I don't know how I would sing that.
Where's Evo now?
I don't want to give away the ending. He's still telling stories, cranking away in a little moon snail shell on the sea.
John Himmelman, who has written The Boy Who Lived in a Shell, Snippets for Wandering Minds. Thank you so much for having your mind wander a little bit with ours. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org. ¶¶